Kia ora koutou katoa, this is Tangato Te Moana from RNZ Pacific, ko Jamie Tahana aho. E haere ake nei, a scathing report into the government's handling of last year's measles outbreak in Auckland, Pacific health workers say it just details what they've been complaining about for years.
It's not just one organisation that failed, I think it was almost like a domino effect.
Efforts to arrest the COVID-19 pandemic in the Marshall Islands community in a hard-hit part of the US appear to be working, and Vanuatu's controversial passport sale scheme comes under pressure. All this and much more this week on Tangata o Te Moana. A failed vaccination program, a lack of experience, inadequate communication, a confused response, and a lack of immediate action are just some of the findings contained in a scathing review into last year's measles outbreak in Auckland. The outbreak ripped through South Auckland, infecting as many as 2,000 people, 750 of whom were hospitalised. It's also likely to have spread from here to Samoa, where it proved deadly. The Pacific community in Auckland was hit the hardest. Pacifica were infected at 14 times the rate of Pākehā. The review, released by New Zealand's Ministry of Health this week, says the outbreak was largely preventable and came about because no real action was taken to fix a large vaccination gap. When an outbreak came, health authorities were slow to distribute vaccines or contact trace, and years of restructures at agencies meant there was no one capable of leading a response. South Auckland GP and chair of the Pacifica GPs network, Apitali Maitonga, says the report laid out what Pacifica health workers had been warning about for years.
It's a preventable, it still is a preventable illness, and I feel sad that we, the collective we as a community, general practitioners, public health, did not do enough to identify when this was happening and stop the tragedy. I mean, the outbreak. It hindsight is fantastic, but we could have been
hindsight
a bit
is
more
fantastic,
proactive.
But you were saying, we spoke in, I think it was August last year, you were saying it's happening and not enough is happening. Were you listened to?
So there was, in my view, a failure at a lot of levels. So, I, as a GP in South Auckland, was beginning to see a case now and again. And then I talked to some of my colleagues who are Pacific GPs in the community as well, who were seeing cases, but none of us had that overview of the numbers and the illnesses that were spreading. And so I feel that if we had had stronger leadership from the beginning, and so we had to fill in notification forms that went to regional public health, who would have been seeing all these notifications from GPs, from hospitals, but the reaction was really slow to tell us, hey, there is an outbreak. It's not just you seeing one or two now and again. It's actually happening. And putting in place measures that would have prevented it spreading further, would have got the immunizations ramped up much faster, and just level of communication and assurance in the community about this.
And each of those points were highlighted, right? The leadership, Auckland Regional Public Health, the three district health boards and the Ministry of Health all in some sense had no idea what each other were doing until quite late in the piece. Is this an experience you felt was borne out?
Yes. It's not just one organisation that failed. I think it was almost like a domino effect. And even, I still remember when the vaccines were ordered, there was not enough of a communication to go out in the appropriate languages, facilitated by the appropriate Pacific providers who, work and live in the community. These are mature providers who know the communities they serve. And what we found in COVID is when we used the providers, our testing numbers hit the roof. People came along. They could be reassured. They trusted this voice. And, you know, I feel bad that I'm saying it now, that I wish it had happened back with measles as well.
I mean, yeah, possibly a good example of a lesson learned, but again, this review does say that these community organisations that you speak of, which you're a part of, we've got so many, the likes of the Whanau and all them, were yep. sidelined, and that the capability to put the messages out in appropriate languages weren't there. But I guess the most glaring thing is this is something you have been saying, the community has been saying for a very long time, and it just so starkly displays the inequities in the health system. So what faith do you have that it's being listened to now?
Yeah, and that's the real disappointment, Jamie, that it's not just my voice, it's the Pacific health sector knowledge and combined intelligence and voices for the last 20 years. And it just falls on deaf ears. We seem to be reactive. You know, we did it with the meningococcal B in the early 2000s, with HPV in 2009. And obviously, the rates of immunizations, the communities responded when we used the local Pacific leadership and infrastructure like church ministers, who are well respected in the community. This was completely absent during the measles outbreak.
There's a whole range of recommendations in the report. From your observations and experiences, does it look like these will be implemented, you know, this time around?
I'm an optimist, and I hope they will be really taken seriously. This is, you know, witness the boat big time on this for our vulnerable communities. But we've learned from COVID, and now there is a kind of shift in the dialogue. People are talking about the inequities much more, the vulnerable communities. We were listened to in COVID, where we were funded as a Pacific sector to stand up our clinicians to do the messaging in the languages out into their communities, to use the church ministers to have a say in where the testing centres and mobile clinics could be placed. So being an optimist, I think it's changing, but we can't take our foot off the pedal. We need to continue to press forward with this message and be listened to by the agencies. We've really pushed ahead with the immunization campaign, and I think I'm a bit worried that nationally the numbers don't look like they're improving or even decreasing in some cases. So we can't, you know, sit on our laurels here. We need to continue to push the vaccination message.
The report does not really touch on how this Auckland and Christchurch outbreak contributed to the epidemic in Samoa. Should it have addressed that? Because, you know, the link is so clear.
The link is so clear. I don't know whether it was the terms of reference of the report that limited that. But, you know, it's within the Pacific community. It is well known that we in New Zealand did export the measles to Samoa. And thereby is another tragedy that could have been avoided.
That's Manukau GP and the chair of the Pacifica GPs Network, Api Talimai Tonga. The Ministry of Health says it's learned lessons from the review and is working to implement the recommendations. A doctor in the northwest of the US state of Arkansas is cautiously optimistic they're finally on top of the COVID-19 threat in the local Marshallese community. That community has been disproportionately impacted by the pandemic, with nearly 2,000 infections and 47 deaths in a population of just 15,000. Dr. Sheldon Ricklin, who is himself of Marshall Island heritage, is part of a task force battling to turn those figures around. He told Don Wiseman, the latest information is that there is just one active case involving a Marshallese.
Well, that numbers, I mean, they definitely look good. And, you know, we're cautiously optimistic. You know, we're thinking that, you know, definitely that the message has gone across to the community to make sure that they do follow the guidelines with face masking, with washing their hands and social distancing. So those numbers kind of speak to that, and we're hoping that is the case. Of course, you know, we're cautiously optimistic because, you know, there's other things that are happening in the community with opening up the schools, and now with the flu season starting up, you know, we're also concerned about that. It's been such a long process and time period that we're hoping that people continue to do what they need to do and not relax at this point in time.
There are plenty of indications that right across the U.S., communities weren't ready for something like this. So I guess the thing now is, will the community be ready for the next ones?
Yeah, and that's the concern. And, you know, at least in the state of Arkansas in general, things are still quite active. You know, it varies between 500 plus to sometimes over 1,000 new cases in 24 hours. So, you know, that's definitely concerning for us because it just shows that COVID-19 is still alive in the community. So we're just trying to make sure people still understand that they need to still follow the guidelines.
People clearly have embraced these moves that you talked about the social distancing, about thinking about their communal living and how that could be a negative factor. And clearly they have got around that. In terms of the communal living, what are they doing? Have they stopped that, or are they just being really particular?
You know, I think, you know, given that the numbers have been, you know, improving the last more than 4 weeks now, and trending for the better for our community. With the communal living, I think it's still there, but they're definitely much more cognizant of it. They're taking more steps and making sure that if they go to work or they go to school, when they come back home, they're protecting the families at home. And they're trying not to go out into the community if they don't need to. They're, you know, definitely trying to not gather in large crowds as much as possible. But, you know, there's, of course, challenges. But, you know, I think as we see it, and we can even see it on social media, that, you know, most people that now we see in the community are, most of them are wearing masks or they're actually social distancing. And the photos are more of being outside and less of being on the inside of the house.
Just to go back to that question about what sort of preparations or thought is going toward what might happen in the future and how the community might handle something similar further down the line. Has any work gone into that?
You know, that, you know, besides our continuing, you know, public education and community education on that, there have also been some efforts into hiring more contact tracers. There's also been more efforts into hiring, you know, health navigators, and they're actually undergoing training at this point. Again, this started off when the numbers were going high, you know, a couple of months ago. And hopefully, you know, as those are being employed and we continue to increase and the number of educational materials, public service announcements, whether on the radio or on the social media or at the different clinics that they come to or different places that they gather, as you know, has been quite, you know, enormous in trying to, you know, address all those changes. And it's been all about, you know, public education and working with and collaborating with some of the health institutions and the hospitals.
That's Arkansas Dr. Sheldon Recklin. Vanuatu officials are coming under pressure over the country's lucrative citizenship for sale system. The parliamentary opposition has been putting the government to task over how citizenship is being granted and to whom. As well, an international tax and immigration expert has warned that Vanuatu's honorary citizenship, which has sold prolifically in recent years, is a ticking time bomb. Johnny Blades has more.
The COVID-19 pandemic has caused an increase in citizenship sales generally around the world. As of mid-August, Vanuatu had earned around $84.6 million in revenue from citizenship sales in 2020, a lone source of economic success in a cyclone-hit year of fiscal strain. But the Director of Passport and Immigration, Jeffrey Markson, denied media reports in Europe that Vanuatu's been selling passports to foreigners who want to flee to a COVID-free country.
We have this citizenship program that is currently going on, that is bringing in revenue, and people who wish to apply for a citizenship, they have to buy for that citizenship. And then one of the benefits of the citizenship is the passport. But to get a passport, you have to follow the dual processes in place.
The system of selling what's called honorary citizenship in Vanuatu has been in place for several years under the Capital Investment Immigration Plan and more recently the Development Support Plan. One of the agents selling the product recently claimed that it signed a deal with Vanuatu to sell citizenship to 300 stateless people. Opposition leader Ralph Regan-Vanu says he's concerned that international criminals and people stripped of citizenship for nefarious activities could more easily become citizens of Vanuatu. But the chair of Vanuatu's Citizenship Commission, Ronald Warsaw, says there's a robust system in place to ensure applicants are first checked.
There are three checks, three to four checks done before an applicant is given citizenship, just to ensure that the people we give them citizenships are not people that, you know, they have adverse records or would cause problems for our country and for the countries that they go through.
People from mainland China make up the bulk of those who have bought honorary Vanuatu citizenship in recent years, at the average price of around $130,000. However, international tax and immigration expert David L'Esperance warns that since they are not full Vanuatu citizens but still possess a regular passport, the travel documents could be misleading at international borders. He says until a distinction is made in the citizenship scheme, Vanuatu is selling a bad product.
This product will work for travel right up until the moment that Australia or New Zealand or the Schengen states realize, hey, there's a whole bunch of people who are presenting us Vanuatu passports who are not Vanuatu nationals.
Ronald Warsaw says he understands honorary citizenship is not being sold anymore.
As far as I am concerned, we only have the, it was only existed previously.
While the Vanuatu Investment Migration Bureau says honorary citizenship ended last year, David L'Esperance says there is no legislation yet to back this up, nor to address the issue of previously minted honorary citizens who hold regular passports.
Nowhere in the legislation is there, for example, it says, you know, in this clause, we remove the term honorary. In this clause, we, you know, this is what we're dealing. Persons who previously obtained this status under Section 1 will, from this port, from the point, you know, we will make them citizens retroactively to the point that they were granted the previous. None of that is there. It just has never been introduced.
The Deputy Prime Minister, Ismail Kalsiko, admits the situation is problematic, but says it will change soon as the government has come up with a way out to protect the integrity of the green passport of Vanuatu.
My team have drawn up policy papers to deal with this issue in the form of a new passport that takes care of persons with honorary status, per people who are here on economic or investment purposes to be afforded a categorization of passport. So it's a sort of an economic passport, different in color. It's just going to be a yellow passport and not the green one. It clears up issues of integrity and sanctity.
While he says a new category of passport is being created, the Citizenship Commission is under fire for another citizenship category, naturalisation. The State Law Office this month advised that the granting of naturalised citizenship to three foreigners had been illegal. Ralph Regan-Vanu is demanding answers.
We are aware that a number of individuals who have not satisfied the requirement of 10 years continuous residence in Vanuatu have now obtained citizenship by naturalisation. We are aware that the processes in the Citizenship Commission are not being properly followed, the law is not being followed, and there's a breach of the Constitution with regard to the giving of these citizenships. And it's something we want investigated. We want the government to deal with it, because if they don't, we will deal with it.
While the opposition claims there are 10 people who have been granted naturalised citizenship illegally, Ronald Warsaw says he can only confirm two cases, one of which dates to before he took up the role.
I understand the wife got the citizenship last year. The commission sat in May, that's when I just assumed office, and I think we granted the husband citizenship on the basis that the wife got the citizenship. That was through entitlement. We are checking through the files to check whether she's entitled or how she got the citizenship.
Meanwhile, David L'Esperance says that honorary citizenship status is a time bomb for Vanuatu if its international travel document is used in a fraudulent way. He also warns it could mean ni Vanuatu are refused entry at destinations abroad. Call Johnny Blades Tene.
You're listening to Tangata Te Moana, news from around the Pacific on RNZ National. Coming up, ahead of New Zealand's election, Pacific climate warriors turn to rallying turnout.
Hey, Pacific communities in Aotearoa said that these are the most important things to them.
And are eligibility rules holding back Pacific netball teams? But first, New Caledonians have been warned of economic collapse if the huge Vale nickel plant closes. Last week, its owner, the Brazilian company Vale, failed to finalise its sale to an Australian company, New Century Resources. And now the site is set to be mothballed with the loss of thousands of jobs. Congress held an extraordinary sitting on the Vale issue this week in what's become a complex and urgent problem. Walter Zweifel listened in and I asked him what exactly prompted the sitting.
The sitting was organised before last week's sale plan was abandoned. It was called because there was strong opposition to the sale with the conditions attached to it. The pro-independence parties and the Canex chiefs were against it because it also involved exporting and selling unprocessed ore, which was meant to be processed in New Caledonia. That concern, of course, has in part become obsolete now that the sales failed.
So is that a victory for the opponent?
Well, not really, and it's not been described or viewed as such. Now, New Caledonia is suddenly confronted with the possible loss of thousands of jobs. The whole discourse has now changed and there's a lot of uncertainty.
What did the Congress discuss then?
Well, the sitting heard from two new bidders to take over this Vale asset. The two are local outfits, Sofinor and BIMS. However, the meeting was rather tetchy and started with a senior politician, Philip Gomez, noting that Vale was not present, which he said made everything even more opaque. But then one can argue Vale is selling and not buying. The main anti-independence party, which is the dominant force in Congress and also in the southern province where Vale is located, didn't want the sitting at all in the first place, but did attend in the end.
Okay, well, what is Sofinor?
Well, it's an umbrella outfit out of the mainly Canek northern province, encompassing its large nickel interests, which includes the Koniambo nickel plant. Significantly, it has a partnership in South Korea. The bid that Sofinor submitted and explained in Congress was built on it securing funds from Korea Zinc, which has a stock market capitalization of $8 billion.
How viable is such a partnership?
Well, according to Sofinor, it is in negotiations with, of course, Korea Zinc and with Vale in Canada, which will decide, and it's not going to be decided in Congress. Its bid, however, has a nationalistic tinge because it would reduce the foreign-owned component. Now, Vale has a 95% stake, but according to the plan submitted by Sofinor, Korea Zinc would have just 44%, and that's how Sofinor's Ulrich Reber put it.
Il s'agit d'une opportunité unique de détenir 56% en fait de cette usine.
As he says, it's a unique opportunity to get 56% of the plant instead of just 5%.
Mm-hmm. And there's another bid. What about that?
Well, that's come from a local company, unknown one, which is BIMS. It has no mining or production facilities, but offers financial and strategic advice in several countries, also to local companies.
Okay, so what came out of the sitting?
Well, things are in flux and Congress adopted an appeal to Vale to keep the plant going and to examine all bits in order to keep it going. It has also set up a coordination committee looking at the plant's survival. All this was, of course, clouded by this rivalry between the anti- and pro-independent sides. It also confirmed that the pro-independence camp's support for Sofinor, as well as the reservations and doubts by the anti-independence Future with Confidence coalition, which, as I said, didn't even want to be part of the meeting and didn't even join the committee then.
All right, so what's the timeline here?
Vale says it'll mothball the plant by the end of next month if no buyer is found, and it also says this is no bluff. Time is tight, and an independence referendum in less than 3 weeks is also coming in between. A shutdown could unleash a cascade of difficulties for the economy. There's talk of an economic collapse and shutdown of social services, pensions and so on.
That's RNZ Pacific's Walter Zweifel. Pacific climate warriors have turned into champions of electoral voting to encourage more Pacifica to get to the polls this election. They're running campaigns out of Auckland and Wellington called Pacific Votes Count. It's about informing communities about enrolment, how to vote, and the importance of doing so. In 2017, turnout was low in areas with large Pacific communities, good example being the South Auckland electorates. Sarah Jane Hopgood has more.
I think so, yes.
Yeah, you're unsure?
Unsure.
Why is it?
I don't actually know who I want to vote for. I think the only person I know is Thor Williams-Seal, and that's about it.
This is a young Pacific voter in Mangere still making up her mind about whether or not to vote. Turnout has traditionally been low in South Auckland, the home of large Pacific populations. Mandy Bote from the Electoral Commission says the only ethnicity data they collect is for Māori.
When we look at populations, in particular electorate, where there are larger Pacific communities, that the enrolment rate tends to be quite high, so, you know, kind of over 90% really, but the turnout rate tends to be much lower.
Pacific Climate Warriors Wellington's coordinator, Mary Moe Onokolio, explains competing priorities are a main barrier.
We're more important about ensuring that we have food on the table, that our kids have shoes on their feet when they're going to school and full stomach and they have what they need when they're there, or even things like that we can afford to get to school.
In Auckland, Brianna Fruin explains the Warriors have switched from climate to voting in the face of the major challenges facing the community.
Hard to get out to the climate strike if maybe the night before you didn't even have a warm house to live in. And so this was really something that inspired us to start Pacific Votes Count.
Pacific Climate Warriors have gone online with topics such as parties' policies, MP profiles, as well as Zoom discussions for first-time voters with guests such as senior health expert Dr. Colin Tukiotonga. Last month, they also conducted an online survey to gauge the most important issues for Pacific people. Ms. Moe Onokolio says warm and affordable housing, quality healthcare, and fair wages were the top priorities.
We want to use those results from the survey to inform our own outreach and our own work, but also go back to the people who are standing for election and say, hey, Pacific communities in Aotearoa said that these are the most important things to them.
The Electoral Commission has been working with Pacifica communities since 2017 to make voting more accessible. Ms. Bote says feedback includes not feeling confident in the voting process on the day and about whether their vote will actually make a difference.
We are recruiting people from the community who understand their community, talking to church groups around really demystifying the electoral process to ensure that people do know that it is easy.
Despite the low turnout rates in the past, this week in Mangere there was a good response of Pacific people confident on who they were going to vote for.
Yeah, Labour. They're for the people, eh?
I vote for the Labour. Very good party for Pacific people.
I like Ganesh. It's good to support Ganesh.
I vote for the Prime Minister.
That's Sarah Jane Hopgood reporting there. Strict eligibility rules are discouraging Pacifica netball players in New Zealand from representing their heritage. ANZ Premiership teams are restricted to one international import in their squads, with Pacific Island internationals forced to compete alongside high-profile names from the likes of Africa and the Caribbean. While at international level, players with dual eligibility cannot represent a different nation at consecutive World Cups, Tale Anderson reports.
Former Silver Ferns defender Linda Vangana spent 8 years coaching Samoa and told the Kiwi Netball show that almost a decade on, the same challenges remain.
Makes me angry, really. I think the opportunities that we can offer girls right across the board, you know, at such a young age to have them, you know, even at ANZ level, for instance, girls have to basically make a decision right from there whether they will be on the New Zealand pathway or on the, you know, a Pacifica pathway. And it's hard.
Northern Mystics midfielder Fa'amu Ioane was born in Samoa but moved to New Zealand 16 years ago and was part of New Zealand's under-21 squad that went on to claim the World Youth Cup in 2017. The 24-year-old admits wearing the black dress is the goal, but said Pacifica players would jump at the opportunity to represent their culture if it didn't affect the chances of national and domestic selection.
The most thing that like hinders the Pacific Islander players is that when we don't make that squad, but then we would love to go play for our country now, but then there's a restriction because if we play for them, we had to stand down for 4 years, and which will also put a restriction on us playing in the ANZ comp. If we do come back and play in ANZ comp, we'll be down as an input player.
Former Australian captain Vicky Wilson coached the Fiji Pearls for 4 years and says there's no shortage of talent in the Pacific, but local players lack exposure to top-level competitions. She guided the Fiji under-21s to an historic fourth-place finish at the 2017 World Youth Cup, but said New Zealand's strict eligibility criteria prevented her from selecting a full-strength squad.
They would have strengthened it tremendously, but they chose to be part of the New Zealand pathway. And sort of you're caught between a rock and a hard place because the game is only as strong as its international neighbour. And we need strength in Pacific to ensure that we're competitive internationally.
Netball New Zealand says the one import rule reflects the fact that the ANZ Premiership is a pathway to play for the Silver Ferns. But high performance boss Keir Hansen says a new initiative has been set up to prioritise Pacifica players for selection.
A system whereby NZ resident or citizen ineligible players are prioritised for payment out of our player payment pool ahead of players who are coming from overseas who might be English or Australian or whatever. And that was really one of the purposes of that, was to, I guess, support our teams to prioritise Pacifica players if they were the right fit for those ineligible spots.
Keir Hansen says only two of the ANZ Premiership's 6 import slots were utilised this season, but Netball New Zealand would not rule out reviewing the restrictions in future. Ko Tale Anderson, tēnei.
And that is Tangato Te Moana from RNZ Pacific. I'm Jamie Tahana. If you want to find out more on the region, just click the Pacific tab at the top of rnz.co.nz. But for now, ka kite anō.